Hi, this is Dr. Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., and there are many more podcasts for this and all our other faith radio shows available on our website. You can just go to myfaithradio.com. And thanks so much for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
A psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Welcome. It's so nice to have you with us today, and we'd love to hear from you. You heard the phone number there. You can call us anytime, 877-93-FAITH. You can also email me at drbill@myfaithradio.com, drbill@myfaithradio.com. You know, I don't know about you, but I have been feeling really grieved this week about the terrible plane crash in France. Any plane crash is a tragedy, but this one was particularly tragic because as I read more and more about this man, the co-pilot who deliberately crashed the plane, I have to believe that this terrible, terrible tragedy could have possibly been prevented. You know, it appears that the co-pilot was a guy who was seriously depressed, so much so that he wasn't able to make rational decisions. And you know, his ability to think clearly was compromised, and he ends up taking the lives of 150 innocent people. But here's the deal. It's really difficult for me to believe that nobody in this man's life noticed there was something wrong with him. I have to believe, he lived with his parents, as you may know. I have to believe that his parents or siblings or friends or coworkers, somebody knew he had serious problems and might put himself or other people in serious danger. And, you know, obviously there's more to this story because depressed people rarely commit murder, although sometimes they do. That's what the research shows. But it seems like this man's mind was clouded not only by depression, but by bitterness and by resentment. And I don't know if we'll ever know the full story as this continues to unfold. But here's my thought. When something like this happens, it should remind us of how important it is to care about and really listen to the people that God has placed in our life, even the tough people, even the difficult people, even the people that may snarl at us from the cubicle down the row in our office, or even the folks maybe in our Sunday school class or at our church that are just kind of, oh, something's going on with them, and they're not easy to talk to, and they sort of stick to themselves, or they're just, maybe they just seem lately to really be struggling with something. Is it possible that you might have a friend or a relative or somebody at your church who is struggling with depression and may even be contemplating taking their own life? And I thought we'd just take a second. I want to tell you about some of the warning signs to be aware of if that could be going on with somebody you know. Has your friend or relative told you that they're feeling hopeless? That they're, you know, wondering if life is really worth living? Are they saying they feel like their life is a burden to other people? Boy, those are big red flags. Have they described feeling trapped? Or maybe they talk about being in unbearable psychological pain. Are they isolating themselves? Just kind of cutting themselves off from everybody? Or showing extreme mood swings? And have they actually talked about wanting to die? Man, oh man, pay attention to these things. These are the classic signs of somebody who is depressed and suicidal. And again, I don't know how what kind of relationships this man had in his life, this co-pilot of the Lufthansa plane. But I just think it's for all of us. It's a wake-up call to pay attention to those that God has placed in our sphere of influence. And, you know, if you have been struggling with depression, let me just say to you that if you're feeling hopeless right now, reach out to somebody. Let them know what you're going through. And 1 Peter 5:7 says this, cast all your anxiety upon God, because he cares for you. God cares for you so deeply, more than you can wrap your mind around. So seek him out. Find people, safe people in your life that you can share your struggles with. And, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ and you know somebody like this that's going through this, remember the Bible tells us to encourage one another and to carry each other's burdens. Well, on a more hopeful note, you looked at the calendar. We're 8 days away from Easter. Can you believe that? This is a week. This is such a beautiful week. I would encourage you, take the time this week to really consider the magnitude of what happened 2,000 years ago in this week. Imagine this. Imagine the God of the universe taking the form of a frail human being, and then voluntarily subjecting himself to torture and to death for you and for me. And then imagine that same God rising from the grave, conquering death, and offering us the gift of eternal life. Man, oh man, isn't that good news? Now that's the big picture. That's the big theological view of Easter. But you know, there's also the personal view of Jesus's resurrection. And that is, you know, you think about it, the perspective of those people who loved him, those people who spent, you know, those 3 years with him in ministry, who walked those dusty roads of Israel with him for 3 years. This week I was just reading through some of the gospel accounts of Easter. And I thought about some of these, but think about Mary Magdalene and her friends coming early Easter Sunday morning to anoint Jesus' body for burial. Okay, think about, put yourself in her place. Imagine her shock at seeing the stone rolled away and then meeting an angel. I mean, one of God's holy messengers right there at the tomb face to face. And then imagine the overwhelming joy that Mary and her friends must have felt when they met the resurrected Christ on the road into Galilee. The joy they must have experienced at that moment is just blows me away. Imagine the disbelief of the remaining 11 disciples when those women ran in and told them what they had seen and heard. And imagine the boldness of Peter. He gets up and he runs as fast as he can to the garden tomb to see for himself what, if this is true, if what the women had told him had really happened. I just love reading the Easter account each year, and I love reading it to my 3 kids. If you're a parent, why not make that an annual tradition? It always seems to me just so fresh every year when I read it. And I have to be honest with you, I'm a pretty emotional guy, and often I'm unable to get through it without, you know, a tear in my eye and a catch in my throat and my littlest little, Daddy, why are you crying? Well, I'm crying because of just the incredible beauty of what God has done for me, for all of us. So I'd encourage you to read the Easter narrative for yourself this week. You can find it in Matthew chapter 28, Mark 16, Luke 24, and John 20. Just, you know, use one of the great Bible reference websites and just put an Easter story and it'll pop up. So, and happy Easter in advance to you and to your family. Well, it's 13 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. And coming up next, we are going to be talking about God's amazing love for us, his unshockable love, as we discuss that with a pastor of a large church in Austin, Texas, who is living that out And the people at his church are living that out on a daily basis. Stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And you can join the conversation by calling us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. And you can also check out our website, myfaithradio.com. Find out about all of our weekend programs and our weekday programs as well. Well, John Burke is joining us this hour. John is the founder, along with his wife, Kathy, of Gateway Church in Austin, Texas. Since 1998, Gateway has grown to over 4,500 members, made up mostly of unchurched people who began actively following Christ at John's church. John's also the president of Emerging Leadership Initiative, which is a nonprofit organization. They're working to help church planting pastors and ordinary Christians raise the church out of the culture. John's a popular author and speaker. His two earlier books are No Perfect People Allowed and Soul Revolution. And today, he's joining us to talk about his new book, Unshockable Love, How Jesus Changes the World Through Imperfect People. And John, welcome to Faith Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me on this morning. Looking forward to it.
Now, before we dive into your book, love to know a bit more about your church in Austin. Austin is an interesting city because it's located in, you know, a very conservative Bible Belt state of Texas, but it tends to have a lot of free spirits. fair number of folks who might actually be hostile to Christianity. And for those of our listeners who don't know, the slogan of the city, the unofficial slogan, is "Keep Austin Weird." So
yes, Austin is kind of the liberal buckle on the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
So how is it? It's mostly unchurched. Interestingly, about 85%.
Really?
Unchurched. It's a college town, 100,000 students, high tech, very. Yeah, live music, capital of the world is what we call ourselves. So,
in a city like that, John, how did, obviously, you know, Gateway, I'm assuming it was a church plant originally. How did you, first of all, feel the call to start a church there? And then what approach have you used to share God's love with a lot of people who may have had, have misconceptions about him or bad experiences in the past?
Yeah, and really, that's why I wrote Unshockable Love, because I've come to believe that what Jesus actually intended for every ordinary Christian is that we would be people that through us, he begins to restore what's lost and broken in the world around us, starting with our neighbors, with our coworkers, with, you know, the people on the sidelines with our kids' sports leagues. And really, that's how we started Gateway. We came here. It was me and my wife and two other people, and that was it. And we just started to meet the neighbors and befriend them and love them and serve them. And, you know, we got to know them, about 10 of our neighbors. And I started coaching soccer, and some of their kids joined. And what we found God doing, and it took years. So over the course of, it was about 5 to 7 years, we saw 5 of our 10 neighbors come to faith in Jesus and start following him. We saw a marriage headed for divorce reconcile. We saw a mom who was an alcoholic and abusive toward her kids just become this beautiful, patient, loving follower of Jesus. And all together, between our neighbors and the soccer team, we saw 24 people, you know, parents and kids baptized, you know, and become followers of Jesus. And the reason I wrote Unshockable Love is because that's what Jesus actually intends for all of us. It's not just for pastors or, you know, professional ministry people. Actually, if you read the Gospels, that's what he equipped these ordinary fishermen to do. And that's actually what it means to follow Jesus. And that really is, the Unshockable Love came out of a 4-month study I did looking at Jesus' encounters with every person. What were his attitudes toward them like? What were his actions like? And I compared those to the attitudes and actions of the religious Pharisees. And what I found is that none of us intend, as followers of Jesus, to slide into more Pharisaical behavior, but I'm convinced all of us tend to, without realizing it, me included, and I've seen it. And so the book is really looking at how do we align our attitudes and actions more toward Jesus rather than inadvertently slipping into the attitudes and actions of the religious of his day that he was really trying to say, no, you know, if you're going to follow me, it's not just about doing religious activities. It's about following me into a world that desperately needs grace and love and mercy and to be led in the way of God.
Why do you think it is, John, that, you know, people who come to Christ and realize the depth of their own depravity, the depth of their own sin, and repent and then, you know, join a church and get plugged in and then start to grow? What happens? What's going on that, you know, kind of causes them at some point to start to become more like the religious leaders of Jesus' day and forget how much they've been forgiven and start to become legalistic? It doesn't happen to everybody, but it does happen to a lot of us.
Well, I think it's not just legalism. You know, it's our sin nature to become it's more, you know, it's challenging to be the kinds of people who engage with people who are far from God that maybe it doesn't feel like we have much in common with. And that's exactly what Jesus did. You know, it was interesting. I took all these attitudes and actions that describe Jesus in the study and the ones that describe the Pharisees. This is about 70 pages of research, and we gave it to the Barna Group, and they put it down into some questions, and they actually surveyed Christian America and just asked them about their attitudes and their actions. And what they found was shocking. Only 14% of Christians in America exhibit more of the attitudes and actions of Jesus than those of the religious Pharisees.
Oops, that's not good.
No, it's not. Now, 21% had more of Jesus' heart or his attitude, but were more Pharisaical in action. And you ask why? You know, well, I think it's just that we're too busy. It's just not a priority. That's what I've seen in my own life. You know, that I've seen it happen well, and then I've seen how I just get overwhelmed and I get too busy, and I just don't think about my neighbors or coworkers, the people around me, as a priority. 14% do the right thing, so they have the right actions, but with seemingly more of a wrong attitude or heart. And then 51% of Christians, by their own admission, had more of the attitudes and actions of the Pharisees than those of Jesus. Now, again, I don't think that's something to be, you know, like, woe is me. We can grow and we can change, and it's something, it's a gray scale, right? It's not all black or all white. And so that's why I wrote Unshockable Love, so that we could really see what Jesus was doing and follow him. And the way we'll know is when our neighbors or our coworkers glimpse a greater love in us and our friends. They see a more abundant life, a new kind of freedom, and they want to know about our God. And it starts with attitude. That's really where we have to start.
Boy, that's well said, John. How do we start? When you say start with attitude, do we need to be gently confronted by our pastor? Do we need to really spend more time in searching the scriptures and reading about how Jesus interacted with others? Do we need a spouse or a friend to come alongside and go, you know, I'm not sure you're really a good representative of Jesus Christ here?
Well, you know, I don't think it's terribly difficult, you know, and that's the first half of Unshockable Love. It's really a study of looking at Jesus' attitude, because what you begin to see is that, you know, it says again and again that tax collectors and sinners were always gathering around him. That's what made the religious Pharisees so uncomfortable. Why were they so attracted to him? Well, I think it's because in his heart, through his eyes, they saw hope for who they were meant to be. And I think it really starts that simply. When you realize that you can tell how people feel about you. You intuitively know if that person is for you or really secretly is kind of against you or judging you or condemning you. You know that. I don't know how you know, but we have an intuitive radar about us. And so we might have the best evangelistic arguments or presentations or apologetic understanding, but the truth is if our neighbors and our coworkers don't know that we are truly for them, not against them, and so therefore God is actually for them, not against them, and that God sees something of value in them, if they don't see that or experience that from us in our attitude, I'm convinced none of our arguments or presentations will matter.
Yeah, I'm so glad you... Go ahead, John. Finish up.
I was just going to say an analogy. My wife and I were missionaries in Russia, and we lived in St. Petersburg, and the Hermitage Museum there hosts my favorite painting in the world, Rembrandt's, you know, famous Return of the Prodigal Son. It's the painting that comes from Luke chapter 15 when it says many tax collectors and sinners were gathered to listen to Jesus, but the religious leaders complained. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son, and when he comes back, the father runs to him and embraces him, you know, showing the heart of God toward the most lost, broken person. Now, that painting is now worth millions of dollars because it's a masterpiece from the hand of the master. It's an original. Now, imagine if you were visiting the Hermitage Museum and you're walking out back and there in a dumpster you find Rembrandt's famous painting, but it's covered in mud, it's stained, it's torn, you barely recognize it. Would you treat it like mud? You know, would you treat it like trash, like it's of no value? Or would you be able to see past the mud and the damage to realize, hey, this is still worth millions of dollars. And in fact, I need to gently take it to a master who can restore it to its original value. You know, I think all of us see past the mud to the masterpiece underneath. So the question is, then why don't we have that attitude toward muddied, sinful, broken people around us? You know, do we, when we see them and we hear, you know, of their immoral lifestyle or their, you know, stained behavior or their, you know, expletives left and right and, you know, this and that, do we focus on the mud or are we able to see past it to the masterpiece that Jesus wants to restore?
Boy,
you know, I think that's really what grace is all about.
That's such a wonderful analogy, John, as I hear you describing that. And you're right. I think oftentimes we are repulsed, we're repelled by the muddiness of those people because, frankly, some of them aren't that likable. They're not, you know, they're people that we would prefer not to associate with. And yet, as we're going to dive into John's book more, Unshockable Love, here in just a bit, you think about how Jesus interacted with the prostitutes and the tax collectors, and how he responded to them and loved them with that unshockable love. Our guest is John Burke. Once again, the book is called Unshockable Love, How Jesus Changes the World Through Imperfect People. We have 3 copies of the book to give away. If you call us and give us your contact info at the end of the hour, we will have a drawing for one of those copies. You can call us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. And we'll take a quick break. Be right back with more with John Burke on the Faith Radio Network.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
So great to have you with us today. My guest is John Burke. He's a pastor in Austin, Texas, and the author of a brand new book called Unshockable Love, How Jesus Changes the World Through Imperfect People. A challenge to every one of us to really love people like our Savior loved them. Listen to what Mark Batterson says. Beneath the surface of every broken person, there is a work of art waiting to be revealed. This book shows us how. That's quite a nice endorsement, John.
Yeah, it is. It is what Jesus was about, and I believe it's what he wants us to be about as well. And when we follow him into the world like that, the great thing is we're not doing it alone. It's why he gave us the body of other Christ followers. So we do it together with his Spirit. And when we follow, it's scary at times. It's risky. We don't know how it's going to turn out. But we see him doing things that we could never do to restore people that are very far from God.
And you actually detail the stories of some of those people in your book. You start off right from the start with a couple named Derek and Zoe. Tell me about those two and then how their lives started to intersect with other people from your congregation.
Yeah, actually, can I tell you a different one first?
Yeah, sure.
I think it illustrates well what I was saying is that what do we see? Do we see the mud or do we see the masterpiece under the mud? And,
sure.
And really this comes from Ephesians 2, 8 through 10, which talks about grace, right? Why grace was given. It says, for by grace we have been saved or set right with God through faith. It's not of yourselves. It's a gift from God. And then it goes on in verse 10 and say, for we are God's masterpiece, created in Christ Jesus to do the good works he planned for us long ago. And that's really the theme of the first half of the book is how do we get that mindset where we see this masterpiece he created for people to become before they ever believed in him, including us. He sees a masterpiece he's restoring in us, and he sees what he wants to restore in others. And when we help them see that, it allows them to trust the master who restores them. So my story is Amy, who came to our church really to shock us because she had heard that we're a come-as-you-are church. That's kind of our motto of grace because that's the way God accepts us as is, right? And she said, I bet they won't, let me come as is if I'm gay. And she had been in a lesbian relationship for 8 years. And she came trying to shock people. And yet what she received was not condemnation engineering, which is what we kind of tend to think we're supposed to do. In other words, if we're going to follow God and stick to the truth, we've got to change people. We've got to let them know what's wrong. And I'll get to what's wrong with that. And it's not that we abandon truth. We hold to the scriptures firmly, but we've got to start with grace.
Sure.
We've got to start with grace. And so what she started to receive from people love and a sense of value despite the fact that she was trying to shock them. And she kept coming and kept coming and started to get to know people. And over the course of, she said it was about a year and a half, so it takes time, she began to think maybe there really is a God. And maybe he really does love me. And she said, I started to hear more and more about how God loved me more than any other person ever could and how he sees a masterpiece in me that was worth dying for. And she said, over time, slowly, she moved closer and closer until she gave her whole heart and life and sexuality and everything to Jesus.
Wow.
And I watched over the next 2 years as Jesus led her on the most beautiful journey of healing. You know, he showed her that first year something she never knew, that her dad, growing up, had had 9 affairs on her mom. And she always felt uncomfortable with her dad, but she never knew why. And he showed her that was part of what was going on inside of her. Then, a year later, she's at a seminar that we were holding on healing, really, from abuse. And she recalled getting off the bus in eighth grade, and she'd completely blocked this out of her mind. And this bully boy who had always bullied her was nice to her that day. He was a young teenager. And he said, I want to make it up to you if you'll come over to my house. And she walked over to his house thinking, you know, finally she won't be bullied. And he slammed the door and 3 teenagers gang raped her.
Oh, no.
8 years old. And what God was showing her is that the reason she was so afraid of her femininity and you know, of men is because evil had perpetrated this on her. And he began to heal her. And since then, you know, that desire has pretty much faded away, and she has been leading so many others toward healing and restoration in Christ. And this is what we see again and again. We've seen drug addicts. We've seen people like the first couple, you know, in the book living together, and, you know, she was a stripper, and just, you know, things that you think, I don't know how to do this. I can't change these people. Absolutely. That was never our job. You know, Paul said, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, God caused the growth. And so what we have to do is start with planting the right seeds, the seeds of grace. And that means, you know, Jesus saw the masterpiece, the Pharisees only saw the mud. So we have to learn to first focus on the masterpiece and call that out in people.
You know, you have so many beautiful paintings and photographs of masterpieces in your book, which really drives home the point that God, you know, dearly loves each one of us, and we are a masterpiece in his eyes. And often, as you said before the break, we are unfortunately tarnished and often even covered with mud, and it's hard for anyone to see that masterpiece. How do we find that value in people? In chapter 3 of the book, you write about restoring value. Explore that with us a bit. How do we do it?
Well, I think the key is relationship. You know, Jesus offered relationship that restored value. The Pharisees distanced themselves and devalued people. And it's interesting because I've heard this many times, that we get the sense that to hold to truth means that we have to make sure that people know how wrong they are first. Really?
Yes.
I mean, that's
sure.
What's taught many times. Mm-hmm. And the only problem with it is, if you study Jesus, that is not what he did. Mm-hmm. It's not what he did. You know, here's a fascinating, I think it's chapter 8, where I talk about the gospel, the good news. I also studied how Jesus used hard words, right? So, when did he talk about sin? When did he talk about, you know, hell and judgment? And because he did say some harsh words, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of think we've got to be like Jesus and do that. But if you actually study the timing of those words, it makes a huge difference. So Jesus said hard words 8 times in his first 2.5 years of ministry, 30 altogether. But in the first 2.5 years, only 8 times did he speak those harsh words, and 6 of them were directed at the Pharisees.
Doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
Now, the last 22 times of expressing hard words, like when he said, "Woe to you, Bethsaida and Chorazin," you know, if Sodom and Gomorrah had seen these things, they would have repented long ago. It was after 2 years of bringing good news of how God sees value in them and how he has good things. He's like a father who wants to give them good things, right? And coming and showing them. I mean, how much better good news could you experience than our diseases are healed, the hungry are fed, the outcasts and lepers are brought in, you know, tax collectors and sinners are restored into relationship, and, you know, like Zacchaeus, right, who, you know, he was a notorious little thief. And when Jesus is passing through and he sees him, he says, "Zacchaeus, come down." And the whole town erupts. They're like, "He's a mobster. What are you doing? You know, you should be condemning him." But Jesus doesn't. He says, "I want to stay at your house tonight. Let's have a sleepover." It's kind of funny, you know, if you think about it. It's like, and the whole town erupted. Why? Well, because where we naturally go is you change people through condemnation engineering. That's the only way they're going to change. Jesus says, no, the only way they're going to change is through relationship. By restoring them to the first relationship they were meant to have, which is with God, so that then they can be restored in relationship with one another in the way he was intending us to live. And so Jesus goes and he says, you know, salvation has come to this house, right? But it wasn't because he rebuked him. It was actually because he valued him enough to relate to him, to be around him.
And what's fascinating about that story, and by the way, I'm glad you picked that one. I love the story of Zacchaeus. I think it's just such a marvelous example for all of us. But what's beautiful about that is that without any condemnation engineering, Zacchaeus does repent. And he says, "Man, I'm going to give this money back to the people that I've stolen from, and I'm going to make everything right," just because that grace was extended to him by Christ.
Yes, and this is what he wants to do through us, and it really does work. I mean, literally, we've baptized 5,000 people over the last 17 years, and I'm talking about people from every imaginable background and mudslinging behavior and pattern you can imagine. But that's not because of what we've done. That's because of what Jesus is still doing. All he needs is our willingness. And the great thing is, if it kind of scares you to think about it, you don't have to do it alone. In fact, the second half of Unshockable Love is all about how, you know, we as Christ followers, with just a few of our friends who follow Christ in our church, can begin to see this outward movement of God restoring lives and seeing them become followers of him with us.
And there is something so powerful about the strength in numbers idea, because oftentimes if we try to do it on our own, I mean, it can be tough, because some of those people are really hard to love, and it's difficult for us to break through that crusty mud, exterior, that dried mud. But when we have others that come, and, you know, several of us, just as we're called, you know, to pray with several of us, two or three are gathered in my name, for two or three to come alongside and not make a project of that person, but to say, you know what, we see that masterpiece beneath the mud, you know, of that drug addict or that gay person, that stripper, whoever it might be, and we want to be like Jesus to them in everything we say and do, and we're not going to ask them to clean up their act, to clean off the mud before they come into our church. There is something, and it sounds like that's going on in the congregation of Gateway. You've got teams of people, groups of people who are saying, this is what God's calling us to do.
Yeah, and I tell story after story of when, not just at Gateway, but in other churches that we've planted, and even places that, you know, they're churches that maybe are more, traditional, and you maybe don't see many people coming to faith as adults. But when a small group of Christians start to do these things that I talk about in part two of Unshockable Love, they do start to see Jesus restore and heal what's lost and broken. And it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to unpack some of the specifics of what those people are doing here on the Faith Radio Network. Our guest is John Burke. The book is called Unshockable Love, How Jesus Changes the World Through Imperfect People. Going to take a quick break. And once again, we do have three copies of the book to give away. If you'd like one of those, be a great book for your church library, for your family to read together. You give us a call right now, 877-93-FAITH, and we'll have a little drawing at the end of the hour for one of the copies. Again, 877-93-FAITH. 93 Faith. We'll be right back after this quick break here on the Faith Radio Network.
Now back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Hey, it's so great to have you with us today. Appreciate you taking Faith Radio with you wherever you are headed this weekend. And we appreciate all of our wonderful affiliates in Faith Radio cities like Madison, Wisconsin, Duluth, Minnesota, folks who are listening today in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or the Fargo-Moorhead area. Maybe you're tuning in Waterloo today. Thanks for taking us with you. And if you're listening here on Faith 900 or 90.7 in the Twin Cities, we appreciate you making us part of your weekend. My guest is John Burke. He's the author of Unshockable Love, How Jesus Changes the World Through Imperfect People. And John, in the second half of your book, you kind of get down to where the rubber meets the road. How do you do these things? And you actually kind of set out a plan that churches and individual Christians and small groups can follow to actually express God's unshockable love to those hurting people around us, and you call it On Mission with Jesus. And let's just walk through a few of the suggestions that you have and how that's actually being done by the people in your church.
Yeah, and it's not my plan. I think it's actually Jesus' plan.
That's good. Good to give him the credit. Always good.
I sure hope so. Or the book's pretty worthless. But it is, like I said, a study of not only Jesus' attitude, but his actions and what he led his disciples to do as well. If you stop and think about it, he brought into his relational network, people like Matthew, who was a sinner tax collector who threw a big party for Jesus with all his partying friends, and the religious were so upset. 3.5 years later, Matthew is a leader of his church.
Mm.
Jesus sent him, commissioned him to do the very things that Jesus had been doing. And that's what we've got to see, is that God really wants to be about restoring what's lost and broken in this world, but he wants to do it through us. And all we have to be is willing to follow him into the world, in our neighborhoods, and with our coworkers, and people that he's already put around us. And so I talk through how it starts with creating relational momentum, and then serving your neighbors with your neighbors, creating come-as-you-are learning space, helping people then come to faith and grow, and equipping them to do the same. And so let me start with the creating relational momentum. You know, if you think about it, this is what Jesus did. He went about, he went to people, and he did dinners and parties and weddings with several of his followers, right? So, you know, in Matthew 11, 19, Jesus said, "The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say he's a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners." Mm. Okay, so they totally misunderstood what he was doing. He says, "But wisdom is proved right by her deeds." In other words, don't worry what people are going to say about you, because wisdom is going to be proved right by her deeds. So let me give you an example. Steve and Joanne were in San Antonio, and they took this attitude of adopt their block. So they started praying for the people on their block and doing things with them. They invited them over for dinner, and then they started to get invited to their parties. Some of them that were kind of uncomfortable and wild, but they would go. And at one of the parties, Steve met Simon. Simon and Terry wanted nothing to do with Jesus at all. They were not Christ followers, but Simon loved to mountain bike ride. And so Steve and Simon started mountain bike riding together and just kind of became friends. And then they would, Steve and Joanne invited Simon and Terry over for dinner, and you know, they were in each other's homes, and then they invited, Steve and Joanne invited some of their church friends to come and get to know Simon and Terry, or to go mountain biking. And so Simon and Terry start to get to know some of Steve and Joanne's Christian friends. And that's a very, very important part of creating relational momentum. What started to happen then is after a while, Steve said, "Hey, you know, our church does this serving project in the inner city, throwing a block party for inner city kids. You want to come serve with us?" And they were like, "Well, that sounds pretty cool. Yeah, we'll do that." And because they already knew some of the Christians who were going to be going and doing it, they went, and they started once a month serving with them. Now, they were having just kind of open conversations about it, and over the course of about 6 months, just it got to be natural, even though Simon still wanted nothing to do with Jesus.
Had they actually brought up the fact that they were Christians? Obviously, they said, "Our church is serving."
Just a natural, "Hey, I'm a follower of Jesus." You know, and just letting the conversation go where it needs to go, but not hiding it.
Right.
Because you create a social contract within about a month or two relationally. And the social contract, if like you say nothing ever about faith, then the social contract is we say nothing ever about faith, right? But on the other hand, if you push too hard too fast, you know, that's what happened is, you know, after about 6 months, Steve said to Simon, "Hey, Simon, you know, some of the people, you know, that you know and name the couples, we all get together and we talk about God and about what it means to follow Jesus. Would you want to come? I mean, it's okay. You don't have to believe it, but you can ask questions." And he was like, "You know, I think I would," because he felt safe with those people. So after their first small group, Simon and Terry are driving home. They later said, Simon said to Terry, "You know, they didn't go all Ned Flanders on us. I think I should go back."
you better tell our listeners. Tell, in case some of our listeners don't know who Ned Flanders is, you better.
Ned Flanders is the obnoxious born again Christian fundamentalist on The Simpsons who's constantly, you know, Homer Simpson says, "Hey Ned, where have you been? I haven't seen you in a while." And he says, "Oh, we've been away at Bible camp learning to be more judgmental." But this is very important because, see, that's the stereotype in their minds. But think about it. Here's Simon and Terry, who they, at that first group, Simon said, you know, he wanted nothing to do with God because his stepdad had become a born-again Christian and was shoving it down his throat. And his stepdad had not been a very nice person before that, so he didn't let him see his good works yet. But then Terry had been abused by her father. So she said, I couldn't ever imagine a heavenly father who actually loved me. But because they didn't kind of attack her and try to fix it, they just let it be. They kept coming back. So think about this. They've never been to church, but now they have Christian friends. They serve with these Christian friends once a month. They're in a small group with these Christian friends. And then, as a result, they did start coming to church as well. 14 months later, Steve baptized Simon and Terry in their own hot tub for faith in Jesus. But here's the other thing. Simon and Terry were bringing friends and Terry's mother-in-law to faith along the way. And it's like the woman at the well who goes and gets all her friends and says, you got to come see this. This is so cool what I'm learning. This could this be, you know, the Messiah? And that's what we see. So we start with creating relational momentum. Then we think about how do we serve our neighbors and even with our neighbors. In other words, like Simon and Steve and Joanne invited Simon and Terry to go serve others because, like Jesus said, the Son of Man did not come to be served but to serve and even lay down his life as a ransom for many. So we think about how do we even invite them to serve with us, but also how can we serve them? Like Karen, she had a boss who was a young single woman who was a harsh taskmaster of a boss, but also was a very immoral and loved to flaunt it, you know, kind of in her Monday morning stories.
Okay.
And Karen had grown up in the church, and she very much felt like she was supposed to make sure her boss knew how wrong that was.
Oops.
And the more she kind of gave her boss the subtle hints of, I don't approve, the more her boss would just be more graphic and kind of poke at Karen, and this wall of animosity grew between them. And then Karen heard a series we did on this, and she started to say, okay, Lord, I need to just pray for my boss. And as she started praying for her boss, she felt like the Lord was saying to her, no, I want you to serve her. So she had to start listening to even find out what was going on in her boss's life and ways she could serve her. And as she started to listen, it changed her perspective. She started to see the masterpiece under the mud. She found out her boss had pets, and so when her boss was going on vacation, she offered a pet sit. And when her boss's car broke down, she offered to give her rides to work. And then she found out when her boss's birthday was, and she organized a surprise party. And all this changed her boss's attitude toward her so much. When her boss got laid off the next year, she came to Karen, and she said, why have you been so nice to me? And it opened Karen up to be able to talk about how, you know, I hadn't really been following Jesus and my attitude toward you and how Jesus actually feels about her. And the boss started coming to church with her. Anyway, about 6 months later, the boss came to faith. And it was about a year and a half later, when I told their story, they both came up to me crying, and they said, can you believe we were once enemies, and now they were running partners, spiritual running partners, we call them, which is like accountability partners. And I said, no, that's what Jesus does. He restores what was once lost and broken, and it's all relational. And so we create relational momentum. We serve our neighbors with our neighbors, and then we create come-as-you-are learning space.
We're about out of time. I hate to tell you this. Our hour is up. But you know what? I want to commend this book to our listeners because as John continues to kind of flesh out how it's done, it's beautiful. It's so inspiring to hear these stories and to know that all of us can do the same thing in our Christian communities. John, I tell you, we're getting a lot of people calling about this book right now who are saying, I want to do this in my neighborhood, in my church, with my small group. I want to thank you for this inspiring book. Once again, it's Unshockable Love, How Jesus Changes the World Through Imperfect People by John Burke. John, thank you for your time today. We're going to continue to pray for you and your church and the wonderful work you were doing there in Austin, Texas.
Well, thanks for all you guys are doing as well. Thanks for having me on today.
John Burke, our guest here on the Faith Radio Network. You have a great weekend, and I'll see you next Saturday at 11 Central. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, just go to myfaithradio.com and click on the program page for Dr. Bill Meyer Live.